From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hi, Ann. You're not with us in the New York studio today. You're at undisclosed location.
Yeah, we're on winter break in the mountains.
In the mountains?
Mountain-ish. Hills?
All right.
Snow?
Well, do you feel a sense of calm and peace? Because that's not what I feel.
I don't feel that. No. There's still news and media here. Yeah, I haven't escaped
it. You're not on a high enough mountain, obviously.
Exactly.
You need to get up on a much higher mountain. Maybe leave the continent.
I don't know.
So lots of stuff happened. The most recent news relates to Donald Trump's pardon of a number of people who will be familiar to folks. We're not going to talk about that right now on the Insider Podcast. What we will do is Ann and I will do a special top of Thursday morning Stay Tuned episode and answer questions and talk about all things relating to those kind of out-of-the-blue pardons, I guess not fully out-of-the-blue. So instead, let's start with what we talked about a bunch last week, which was the Roger Stone prosecution and the flip-flop from the DOJ on what the sentence should be. And we, both of us, criticized Barr pretty heavily. And then just as I was getting ready to go on stage for a book event in Pittsburgh last Thursday, news broke of this new interview that Barr did with ABC News where he said a bunch of things. A couple of things, I want to get your reaction to this, Ann. Among other things, he said,
to have public statements and tweets made about the department, about people in the department, our men and women here, about cases pending in the department, and about judges before whom we have cases, make it impossible for me to do my job.
He also said that he didn't agree with the original sentencing recommendation, but then he did say,
the Stone case was prosecuted while I was Attorney General, and I supported it. It was established he was convicted of obstructing Congress and witness tampering, and I thought that was a righteous prosecution, and I was happy that he was convicted.
So lots of speculation about what the hell is going on with this sudden sort of more harsh rhetoric by Bill Barr. What do you make of it?
Yeah, and I mean, the other piece, in addition to Barr's statements, they've also leaked out and put out a lot of information from the AG's office, basically saying that there were internal discussions about the Roger Stone sentencing, that Barr disagreed with it before. And look, I'm a career prosecutor, and so maybe I'm cynical on this stuff, but I find it all very hard to believe. I mean, it feels to me a lot like Barr got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, and he has been consistently, and we should go through all the ways in which I think Barr has been extremely political as the attorney general, but it feels to me like, you know, he did this. He did not think he would be held accountable. There was a very swift backlash from career prosecutors and frankly, just normal people who believe that the president shouldn't interfere with law enforcement, which it's very clear the president had just tweeted about the Stone. And so I found this sort of what I would assume is a very hastily arranged interview of Barr to be kind of one of those things where he says something, I have such a hard job with the president doing this, that if you really look at the facts behind it, it can't really be true, right? I mean, this isn't the first time the president, to my recollection, has tweeted about a criminal investigation. He tweeted nonstop about the Mueller. He tweeted nonstop about Comey. He's tweeted nonstop about McCabe. He's tweeted nonstop about angry Democrats.
Yeah.
The IG report from DOJ. And, you know,
so
he's
what do you
the
think,
one that
then?
Put
do you
out.
Think,
yeah.
Do you think, because I've been struggling with this also. I don't think it's completely 100% insincere insofar as he probably is annoyed at the tweeting. Do you think it's because he's facing an internal rebellion? I mean, I've talked to folks. I know you have. People are really upset. This is a big deal to prosecutors.
I don't think I've ever...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you tell me, but I've talked to a bunch of folks. I don't think I've ever heard people as upset as I've heard them in the past week. And, you know, I was in the Department of Justice under the George W. Bush administration. And, you know, there were allegations, particularly at the end of that administration, that Gonzalez had made the department a lot more partisan and political.
And, I helped to conduct that investigation.
Exactly. And I was about to say, I think that that has merit. This is to the next level, though, of actually having what appears to be the president tweeting about cases. And then we should all take this in the context of, you know, we can't really isolate it to Barr's interview and what Barr tells us. We have to look at conduct. And you have the president basically saying, you know, I'm not interfering, but I can. I have the right to. I mean, basically sort of declaring himself on top of the criminal justice apparatus of the country. And Barr saying, you know, like to me, it just feels a little too little and too late and an effort to try to calm the ranks of the department of the career men and women. I don't know. What do you think?
Did you see yesterday that the president said about himself, I am the chief law enforcement officer of the country. And I got asked about that. And it's weird to contemplate, right? Obviously, people who are in the law enforcement business understand that the chief law enforcement officer is the attorney general. Obviously, the president sits above the attorney general, and the attorney general, you know, serves at the pleasure of the president. It's also funny, Jim Acosta at CNN, I think, posted quickly something from the website of the White House describing the responsibilities and the jobs of the various members of the cabinet. And that also says the attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer of the country. The problem to me is not the language so much as what Donald Trump appears to be asserting about his own power, that until this sort of somewhat feeble interview with ABC News, Bill Barr seems to be acquiescing in. And that is, I, the President of the United States, because I have a legal right to do so, can reach down into any case of any person who's an ally of mine who may have committed his crimes on my behalf or to protect me or my campaign, and I can order something lenient for that person and or anybody I don't like, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Michael Bloomberg, anyone else, I can order an investigation by name of that person. That is not breaking a law unless there's a quid pro quo involved. But I'm able to do that because I am the chief law enforcement officer of the country, and that is incredibly dangerous, and I'd like to see some pushback from the attorney general on that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when I was AG, I was the chief law enforcement officer for the state of New Jersey by statute. When you were the U.S. attorney, you are the chief law enforcement officer for that, for the Southern District of New York, except obviously the AG is the chief law enforcement officer for the country and can override a U.S. attorney. But it really is, it is done, and it was even specified in the New Jersey state laws and constitution in order to basically say that that's the person who gets to decide on criminal prosecutions. It's not the governor. It's not the president. And I think for people just to understand how important this is, in my experience, when I was going to be the AG, my only condition was, and there was no issue with the governor that I was working for, but my only condition was everything criminal is independent from everything else. That's the way all of us operate. And I think the other question I wanted to ask you is that Barr comes out and he does this ABC interview, which, you know, he does change the narrative, right? And one of the things that the administration is great at is framing the issues. And so Barr all of a sudden changes the narrative to be like, look, the president is making it hard for me to do my job. He's making it impossible for me to do my job because he's tweeting about criminal cases. Now, you and I have seen countless times where people go against the president. And what does the president do? He crushes them, right? I mean, it's in every single way, whether it's by tweet or he fires them, he pushes them out of the cabinet. And none of that happened here, which leads me to believe that it was all prearranged, that Barr probably had someone call over and say, look, I need to push back. There's, you know, the president has stepped over a line. I need to push back. But I sort of see Barr as this wily tactician who's working on the inside, who's in some ways doing everything the president wants. What do you think?
So I have a slightly different view. A couple of things. One, it's interesting that all these things happened before and Barr kept his mouth shut and he didn't care. The fact that he felt the need to say something this time and put some distance rhetorically between him and the president, to me, indicates that he appreciates this is a bigger firestorm than other things. And he had to do some separate, because he could have said nothing. It's like, no, I do what I do. I don't care. I'm going to die. I don't care about my legacy like he's suggested before. So that he understands this is a bigger deal than prior things. I don't think that there was a prearrangement. I don't think that Donald Trump suffers criticism from anyone, even somebody who has for, you know, 99 days in a row kissed his feet and applauded him, whether that's Matt Gaetz or that's Rupert Murdoch or that's Bill Barr, but that he understands, not through prearrangement, but that Barr needs to say a couple of things. I've seen some reports that suggest the president's kind of annoyed and fuming a little bit about the suggestion that he should stop tweeting. I mean, he went before reporters in the last day and said, tweeting is important to me. It's how I get my voice out. I agree with you that Barr is a wily, crafty guy and is trying to figure out how to thread the needle between, you know, putting out there some suggestion that he has some independence at long last, I don't know if I believe it or not, and that the president is still annoyed. I mean, the other thing I saw that seems very calculated in the last day is, I think the Washington Post, was it, reported that Barr has told multiple associates he may think about resigning if the tweeting and the other kind of interference continues. I don't know that I believe that. I mean, some people speculated, yeah, he's going to have to deliberate on that for at least 9 months until the election.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you think
Barr
is resigning anytime soon? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. And I agree. I think, look, the White House and the Attorney General, when they put a story out or they leak a story out, it gets front page news. And so they're really able to control this narrative. And this is about Barr's reputation. You and I have both said this. You know, he's been a longtime practitioner. He was the Attorney General before. Many people expected him to be a rule of law person. I would argue he's been far more political than I think anyone anticipated, even with the memo he'd written prior to going in as AG that was critical of the Mueller investigation. I still think that he's been more extreme than I expected. But I do think that kind of speculation is more aimed at basically saying, you know, Barr is trying to be a good steward of the Department of Justice, and he is going to step down if he has to. He's pushing back on the president. And again, I think, you know, actions speak louder than words. I also come back to this fact, and I don't know what to make of it, but I actually do think in some ways Barr got a pass on the Zelensky call, the July 25th, 2019 call, you know, the day after Mueller finishes his testimony, when Trump talks to President Zelensky about the Biden-Ukraine investigation. He mentions both Giuliani and Barr by name. And Barr was, we sort of all forgot about Barr, but I do worry that Barr may, in his mind, not believe that he's doing the president's bidding, but in the president's mind, it seems clear to me that Barr is doing his bidding. And if we just look at the evidence, it seems to me clear that Barr has been very favorable to the president's political wishes.
And by the way, that's a great point that you make, because the president, Barr says, I independently came to the conclusion in this one case out of tens and tens of thousands that I needed to put my stamp on it and reverse what their sentencing recommendation was, when he never has done that in any other case. I've never seen an attorney general do that in any case that I oversaw in 8 years almost as the U.S. attorney, and says, I did that without seeing the president's tweet. I was going to do that anyway. And then, of course, the president tweets something like, I'm very pleased that Barr took control of the case and did what I essentially wanted him to do, ruining this, you know, this rhetorical attempt to try to say that you're acting independently. But, you know, speaking of resignations, you and I both saw a letter that now has, I think, more than 2,000 signatories of people who used to be in the Department of Justice, prosecutors and other kinds of folks, calling for the resignation of Bill Barr. You didn't sign that letter, did you?
I did not sign it. I actually hadn't seen it until it was made public. You know, someone on Twitter asked if you wrote it, Preet.
Well, I didn't write it. I didn't sign it. I agree with many of the sentiments in the letter. And just to be, so people keep asking me this question, I'm sure they ask you. I tend not to sign on to group letters written by other folks. You and I are both privileged to have platforms of our own on the podcast. We can write, we can go on television, and I can articulate in my own voice and in my own words why I think Bill Barr has violated the oath of his office, how he's not independent, and why he should go. But the fact that I didn't sign the letter doesn't mean I don't agree with the conclusion of the letter.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one thing about the letter that I think is worth pointing out is that it is bipartisan, and it's strongly bipartisan. It's career prosecutors who were there under both Democratic and Republican AGs and who are affiliated with both political parties. And I think that's the thing that people should really understand, that it doesn't matter what political party you're a part of, that this stuff, you know, the president being able to dictate or even have the appearance that the president is dictating who gets prosecuted, what the right sentence is. I mean, it just destroys the rule of law.
Yeah, and look, as you said, there are bipartisan calls to condemn this. This issue of sort of favoritism to cronies and trying to attack your enemies is not a partisan issue. It's not something that's just done by Republicans. Democrats can do the same thing, and you can have a future president based on this precedent deciding, you know what, I had these business associates who kept quiet about me and were prosecuted otherwise, and I'm going to help protect them, or I'm going to go after my enemies. There's nothing about this that's ideological. It's just raw use of power. So a lot of people also ask, what do you think this means for Roger Stone and Michael Flynn? My view is, I think it's almost without doubt, I guess a little bit depending on what happens with Roger Stone's sentencing tomorrow, Thursday, that he can expect a pardon from the president. And also Michael Flynn, don't you?
Absolutely. I don't have any question. Look, some of this feels to me like a setup to that. The president has been tweeting out about the foreperson of the Roger Stone case, saying that Stone deserves a new trial. Now, Barr has pushed back on that, but, you know, we should be very clear that I think there's a couple pieces happening here. One is the president, I mean, he pretty much outright said that this is politically advantageous to him, and it's advantageous with his base. And so he's making these arguments basically saying Stone deserves a new trial. They're not based in fact or law at this point. They're really just speculation based on his view that people who belong to one political party can't discharge justice fairly as a juror. But the president is sort of creating this narrative about how unfairly Roger Stone has been treated. You know, he's questioned whether the case should have been brought. He's questioned whether the jury foreperson was biased. He's questioned DOJ asking for such a harsh sentence. And so to me, it's all a lead up to basically say, I'm going to pardon him. And frankly, the pardons and the commutations in the past week seem he's socializing us to this idea that he's going to use this power to get people who've been convicted of political corruption crimes. He's going to basically absolve them of their crimes. And so
don't you
feel like it's just, it's like a, you can almost sort of chart out what the next steps are. I assume he'll wait. Do you think now he'll wait? Sentencing is Thursday.
Which is tomorrow.
I assume he'll wait till after.
We should talk about that a second. And can I confess error on something?
Yes.
Because I think that's an important thing to do. So I predicted when Judge Amy Berman Jackson heard about the withdrawal of the career prosecutors from the case and then ordered a telephone conference yesterday with the parties for both sides, that I hoped and expected she would take that opportunity to ask about the reasons for the withdrawal and the reasons for the change in position on the sentencing, because I've seen that was the way in which I think the judge in Southern District of New York, Jesse Furman, was going about it with respect to the census case that we talked about, and she did none of that. She had a conference call. It was focused mostly on the question of whether or not she has to decide the juror question, the new trial motion, based on the accusation of a biased juror before the sentencing, or could she just go ahead and sentence Roger Stone and then not mandate that he goes straight to prison? He could wait on the sentencing, you know, actually serving the sentence, until she decides the new trial motion. She didn't ask about the change of position. She didn't ask about the withdrawal of the prosecutors. So I was 100% wrong when I predicted otherwise. Just wanted to say that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I thought she might have more questions of the attorneys as well. Can we talk about one thing in terms of Barr's reversal, him requiring the acting U.S. attorney in D.C., Tim Shea, to write that second memo basically saying that the sentence was too long as recommended, that they were deferring to the judge, but that it should be less? One of the things I've thought a lot about is that, you know, you've got this sentencing hearing tomorrow. The prosecutors speak, the government speaks, and defense lawyers speak. And it feels to me that even if Barr had disagreed, and I just want your gut on this, even if Barr had disagreed up front, and, you know, I don't buy this, Barr didn't know that there were discussions happening and at the last minute, Tim Shea changed the recommendation or something like that. I actually don't buy that. But let's just say it's true for a second, and Barr then sees they recommend 7 to 9 years. He thinks it's too long. Isn't the way to deal with that, like if you're sitting in the Southern District as U.S. attorney, somebody does a recommendation you think too long, isn't the way to deal with that at the sentencing hearing to basically say to the prosecutors, like, look, you filed your papers, but now, you know, stand up in court and say, we're going to defer to you, Your Honor.
Yeah, look, just in terms of optics, I mean, we talked about this last week, whether or not he independently and in good faith thought it was too high a sentence. Once the president intervenes in this way via Twitter, and given the surrounding circumstances of this being a close ally of the president who lied on behalf of the president's campaign, you stay the F out of it. And at most, you try to do it in a subtle way, like you just described. What people may not appreciate is there were times where you walked into a sentencing hearing. I did that personally myself, where the sentencing guidelines called for a particular sentence, which was like, you know, a little high. Particularly back when I was a line prosecutor for much of that time, the sentencing guidelines were mandatory. And it was Justice Department policy that you were supposed to support the actual formal sentencing guidelines calculation. So you couldn't go in even. It would be an act of insubordination in some ways to go in and say, what Congress passed with respect to the sentencing guidelines is unfair and unjust and too high. And what you did when you thought that, given your own perceptions of the uniqueness of the case and the particular facts of the case, you just didn't, you know, yell about it. You just weren't strident about it. I mean, I would get up sometimes when I thought the sentencing guidelines spoke for themselves and it was up to the judge to decide. And the judge would say, Mr. Barrera, you may proceed. And I would say, I have nothing to add beyond what's in the papers. Or when the defense lawyer would make an argument on behalf of his or her client that was mitigating in some way, and I was asked to respond, I would say, you know, those are fairly well taken points. Once again, Your Honor, what we say in the sentencing memorandum is what we stand by. And judges get a sense of how strongly you feel. And there are other times where there's an outrageously low sentence that's being advocated by the defense lawyer that would make it a complete travesty for this person in a situation similar to other people who got much more time in prison. And because of fairness, you argue much more stridently and strenuously in those cases. But all you're exactly right. All of that could have been done with a little bit more, you know, subtlety without this new sentencing memorandum and the you know, people resigning, everything else. I mean, maybe it would have been hard to do, as I think about it aloud, if you had four pretty strong-willed career prosecutors who wanted to take a particular position. I don't know how you would have gotten them. I mean, I agree with you that that was a better way to do it, but I don't know how you would have gotten them to sort of backtrack orally at the sentencing hearing if they felt as strongly as it's reported they did feel
Yeah, or just rest on the papers, which would have not undercut them, but not basically had them standing up and arguing it, which again would have sent a message to the judge. I think the biggest point here is just as I've thought about it, I think the way that Barr has portrayed it is he had no other option than to undercut the prosecutors in this way. And it just strikes me as that's not true. If, in fact, it was legitimate that he was surprised, and again, I don't believe it for a second, but if it were, there are other options and other ways to have sort of dealt with this, with an understanding that the judge ultimately decides, the judge presided over the case. And so it feels to me like the framing of this has been really binary. Like, he felt the sentence was too high, so this is what he had to do. And he may have very well felt that the sentence was too high, but I believe that there were other options.
But, you know, just again, once again, we're a little bit falling into the trap of discussing this on the merits and saying, well, you know, what did Barr think about the sentence? Did he in good faith think the sentence was too high? I'm prepared to concede all of those things. But why this case? Of the tens and tens of thousands of cases in the Justice Department, the thing that's alarming to me and should be alarming to everyone is not that he had a particular view of a case which you might have in good faith, but that he chose to reach down in an extraordinary and, I think, arguably unprecedented way with respect to one guy who's friends with the President of the United States, who the president talked about and said was treated unfairly when there are literally, over the course of a tenure of the administration, hundreds of thousands of people find themselves in this position, and he doesn't seem to give a damn about any one of those. That tells you something about whether there's a double standard. It's not even a double standard of justice. It's a unique, narrow lane for one tiny group of people, the people who are close to the president.
Yeah, look, and it feels like corruption. I mean, I would say, like, this is the kind of thing that comes very close in my mind to something where it is the exact opposite instinct that you and I would have, right? My instinct would always be to stay out of something like this. This type of sensitive political corruption case being a more extreme version of separating politics out of, by its very nature, you have to separate politics out of these types of investigations. And so Barr's instinct to sort of single out this case is exactly the opposite of where I think a rule of law prosecutor attorney general should be. And so that is why I think that is the right issue to be focused on, why he did this case, why he did what he did, and what it says bigger. I think you're right.
So before we move on to the next topic, two quick things. Do you think Bill Barr should resign?
I do think he should resign. I don't think he will, but I do think that there's a rule of law issue here that is deeply troubling to me. And, you know, I'm not convinced that he can do his job in the way that I think the attorney general needs to be able to do his job.
So my view is he hasn't shown himself to be fit for the job in all these ways that require independence. I do worry that you can get much worse next time around. We had Matthew Whitaker, who I don't know if you can call him better or worse, but he was also unfit for the job. So I think he's not fit. He should go, but we'll see what happens with that. Final question, quickly. I'm not going to make a prediction because the last time I did, I was totally wrong. Do you have a prediction on what sentence Roger Stone will get?
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think the judge will give him a stiff sentence because she presided over the case and because she has seen, you know, he's been convicted of 7 crimes, which are serious and carry serious sentences. I don't know that he gets 7 to 9. I would have guessed more 5 to 7, but I do think it's possible that he gets the full weight of the guidelines. The one thing, and I'm going to be weedy here for a second, that I'm not sure about is that one of the guidelines calculations includes his defiance of the judge and the sort of, you know, when he did the crosshairs on one of the social media posts he made about Judge Amy Berman Jackson. And so, you know, if you're the judge, it feels a little weird to me to include conduct toward you in the sentence you give someone. And so I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't take off, I can't remember if it's 2 or 3 additional points, but that would cut down the sentence a little bit. So I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't drop that off. But again, we should note that the sort of pre-sentence report includes the sentencing guidelines as the government did. And so it is well within reason for her to do the 7 to 9, given the way the calculations have been done. So also this week, right after this sort of whole thing was happening with Stone, the Justice Department, the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office made an announcement about Andy McCabe that seemed to be surprising in some ways that it came now, although my understanding is that there were some pieces that were moving, that there was a FOIA request that the government was going to release some information related to the McCabe matter. And so the Department of Justice made a decision not to prosecute Andy McCabe. And, you know, I would love to get your thoughts. I mean, it felt very closely calculated to make a statement about the independence of the Department of Justice from the president, in my mind. But what was your reaction?
Yeah, so just to remind everyone, Andy McCabe was the former deputy director of the FBI who got criticized pretty robustly by an inspector general report for lack of candor in connection with an internal administrative inquiry as to, you know, what he did with respect to talking to the press. And one thing that gets lost in all of this, by the way, because Andy McCabe gets painted as somebody who hates the president and was trying to destroy the president, the thing about which he might have been charged and the thing about which he was criticized in the IG report was a leak to the press that was critical and damaging to Hillary Clinton, right? You know, at the bottom of all this, in the same way with Jim Comey, the president claims that Jim Comey is trying to destroy his presidency. The actions that are at issue that initially the president had Rod Rosenstein set forth were things that were harmful to his political opponent. So that's not relevant legally, but it's, I think, relevant atmospherically. So at first I thought, yeah, this is another example of, well, we might as well put up or shut up now on Andy McCabe to show that we're, you know, we, Bill Barr and others are a little bit independent. But then, as you point out, it looked like a bunch of damaging stuff was going to come out with respect to this FOIA report, including what you already mentioned. And that is that the judge in the case, Reggie Walton, expressed great dismay and concern that by leaving Andy McCabe out hanging, and also in the context of the president naming him by name and saying over and over again, he's a criminal, and then basically making sure that he was terminated the day before he was going to vest in some portion of his pension, show that you have what we've been talking about on now on multiple fronts, a president who doesn't stay out of it, who thinks he has certain political enemies and allies, and he pronounces what should be done with respect to those people when he should stay out of it. So I don't know if the timing was fortuitous or not, but it certainly, you know, raises a lot of questions.
Can I read the quote from the Judge Walton unsealed transcript? And this is from September 2019. Quote, "The public is listening to what's going on, and I don't think people like the fact that you got somebody at the top basically trying to dictate whether somebody should be prosecuted. I just think it's a banana republic when we go down that road. I think there are a lot of people on the outside who perceive that there is undue, inappropriate pressure being brought to bear. It's just, it's very disturbing that we're in the mess that we're in that regard." And of course, Judge Walton is a George W. Bush appointee. There's sort of a number of layers of this, and it's worth going back just to talk about those for a second, which is that it's very clear that the McCabe case was a hard case. And you and I talked about this a number of times. He lied. There are four instances in which it was found that he was not truthful by the inspector general's report. And some of those were to FBI agents who were doing sort of an internal leak investigation. And some of those were to the DOJ inspector general's office, who also were doing this internal investigation. That was then referred to the DC U.S. Attorney's Office for possible prosecution. It's worth noting, it's just really unusual to see when somebody is dishonest in an administrative internal office proceeding. It's unusual to see that prosecuted.
I think there are very few precedents for that. And just to be clear, I think that the conclusion of the inspector general report, and maybe this is semantics, maybe it's more than semantics, was that he was not candid. He lacked candor, which some could argue is something different from that he lied or intentionally lied. Although maybe we're debating, you know, angels on a pin.
Yeah, I mean, I take a pretty hard line that what McCabe did was, you know, you can call it lack of candor, you can call it lying, but he did something that he shouldn't have done, in my view. You know, he leaked information to the Wall Street Journal that was personally beneficial to him because he was being attacked for being partisan because of his wife's political
campaign.
But
that's not the thing that got him in trouble. What got him in trouble was not being candid about the fact
that exactly, he did that. Exactly. But that's the sort of the genesis. And what I think is he lied or was not truthful for a very human reason, because he did something that he shouldn't have done. And also he was trying to protect his family and not look as though he was biased. And I understand it, but I also think that I would not justify what he did in any way, shape, or form. And it's understandable to me that he was terminated. It doesn't mean he wasn't a good FBI agent. It doesn't mean that, you know, he didn't distinguish himself in other ways. But in these instances, I think he's been terminated. His pension was taken away. He was, because of the timing of the termination, it never felt to me like this was correct for a criminal prosecution, both because it's an administrative proceeding. He also later corrected the record. So even though he had not been truthful, he came back and said, well, wait, now here's what I understand, before there was any talk of criminal prosecution. So for a lot of reasons, I think they did the right thing not to prosecute.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't persist in the falsehood, which makes a difference in ultimate decisions to prosecute. But also, the reporting is that they did try to prosecute him. It's not like they decided to, you know, let it go, but they brought the case to the grand jury. I don't know if this is true or not, but if it is true, and they did bring the case to the grand jury, and the grand jury, in our experience, and as people understand from common experience, you know, the grand jury generally approves of indictments, and the fact that they didn't meant that they had an even weaker case than you and I have been discussing. And in the context of a grand jury rejecting the case, giving it a no true bill, as they say, was another reason why they might not have gone forward, and it was sensible and right not to go forward. What do you make of the people who compare the McCabe case to the Flynn case, which both had to do with false statements and people saying, well, if Flynn was charged, then McCabe should have been charged?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's definitely floating in the conservative legal circles, is this idea that how come, you know, members of the president's team were prosecuted for 1001 for lying and McCabe wasn't. I mean, there are a number of distinctions, including the fact that McCabe, it was an internal administrative review. It was not a criminal investigation, whereas Flynn was always a criminal investigation when they went in. There's also the issue with Flynn never came forward to tell the truth until later, after he'd been, you know, the investigation, he was essentially about to be charged with a crime, and then he became a cooperator, whereas McCabe voluntarily came forward on his own prior to a criminal investigation being started to tell the truth. And also, they just dealt with very different subject matters. I mean, McCabe was authorized to leak to the Wall Street Journal. You know, again, we could debate whether he should have or shouldn't have. The issue was him not being truthful on that later, whereas Flynn, we're talking about, you know, the president taking actions with regard to a foreign country, Russia, and then Flynn lying about it. So it feels to me they're different cases. And again, I think your point is the right one. The grand jury clearly had concerns about the strength of the case or the fairness of the case against McCabe in D.C., that there were issues there that they did not have or apparently would not have had on the Flynn matter. And remember also that Flynn's plea to 1001, he was being looked at for failing to register as a foreign agent. There were a number of crimes that he could potentially have been charged with. He pled to the 1001 as part of a deal and a package because that was advantageous to him. It gave him this very low exposure on the sentencing guidelines. And so it's a little apples and oranges when the 1001 was the most serious crime that McCabe could potentially have been charged with, whereas Flynn faced a number of other equally or more serious crimes.
So speaking of Flynn, before we go, we should discuss this other kind of bizarre thing that's happened, at least in my experience, and that is that Bill Barr has assigned other U.S. attorneys to review some of these cases that are sensitive, but more importantly, the common thread is that they're cases that the president is not happy about and relate to associates of the president or the investigation of the president, and one of those is Michael Flynn.
Yeah,
even though
what do you
you've
make
had
of
a
this?
Court. Yeah, so it is weird to me because there is something called the Office of the Inspector General. There's something called the Office of Professional Responsibility. There's also something called the court. And all three of those have a role to play in making determinations about whether or not a prosecution was brought in good faith or the people who were involved in the prosecution and the conduct of a trial or a guilty plea proceeding acted properly and ethically. And in every other case that I've ever heard of, when there are questions raised about those things, those are the entities that make decisions about them. I never was asked once in almost 8 years to look at a case and review something that another office did for the purpose of trying to determine if they did the right thing or not. And I'm not sure that's a great way to go about it institutionally.
Yeah, I think you're raising exactly the right issues here. It has happened before that when attorneys are alleged to have violated discovery rules or to have not turned over Brady evidence that's exculpatory that would show that a defendant wasn't guilty, for example, those always go through the Office of Professional Responsibility. I mean, there are existing mechanisms through which people can be held accountable or reviewed. What it seems like Barr's doing, first of all, it seems like it's a review of the decisions made by Mueller. It looks like he's sort of Monday morning quarterbacking those decisions. And it feels like it's not about misconduct per se. He's almost trying to second guess the judgment of the career prosecutors. And that is something I've never heard of happening. Again, if there's a predicate or a reason to believe that an attorney or an agent engaged in misconduct sufficient to have that individual looked at, for example, that's something that would be referred to OPR. But this idea of handpicking U.S. attorneys to go in and Monday morning quarterback decisions, which many of which, by the way, you know, you and I have both been involved in cases where prosecutors can disagree. Do you do the search warrant now or do you approach a witness? Do you go up on a wire or do you try to get more bank records? I mean, these are legitimate, often investigative decisions that reasonable and good prosecutors can disagree about. And it feels to me a very, very dangerous precedent to set, to start saying to lawyers who are acting and there's been no allegation of specific misconduct against them, the same
and
as
there's
the
a
agents.
Court. And there's a court.
Yeah, exactly.
And allegations have, you know, there's very, you know, he has new counsel now, Michael Flynn, and they are very aggressive and they make all sorts of accusations. And it's just bizarre to me that in the context of an ongoing case, you know, it's not done, right? These allegations are still being made. There's a question about whether or not he can withdraw his guilty plea. He still hasn't been sentenced. I would have been incredibly uncomfortable trying to second guess another prosecutor's office. Now, I will say in fairness, that the only thing that I can think of that comes anywhere near this is in a case that I can't give you the details of, but there was once an investigation done by another office, and they determined that they didn't have enough. They didn't feel comfortable bringing a charge. And the law enforcement agency thought, well, that was a bad judgment, not an unethical judgment, but they thought that they were maybe a little bit, you know, not aggressive enough. And we had a reputation for being aggressive. And I was asked, and I thought about this for a while before accepting the responsibility, could you also take a look? Do you think you could make this case? And that was not a situation in which we were passing judgment on a case brought where there was an allegation that some target or defendant was treated unfairly. That was a case in which a particular office with a particular staff decided, you know, we don't think we can win this case, and we don't think there's enough, and we took a look. We came to the same conclusion. We did not bring the case either after a months-long investigation. That's the only thing that comes close to this. I think it's a different kind of thing.
Well, let me give one other example where I think, you know, you can understand this being potentially legitimately done, which is the Jeffrey Epstein case, where it has been reported that there was serious issues with how the then U.S. attorney in Florida, Alex Acosta, handled the case with the deal that was given to Epstein. Remember, they did not do a federal prosecution. They didn't notify the victims. They gave it to the state for a local prosecution in which Epstein got really the equivalent of a slap on the wrist. And that case is now being reviewed in Georgia, or was being reviewed in Georgia. And so there are instances where there's misconduct that rises to the level of saying, okay, and I believe that Georgia is actually reviewing the failure of the Florida office to comply with the Crime Victims Act, their failure to notify the victims and to figure out what the harm, you know, they understand what the harm should be, but what the remedy should be. So there are rare occasions, but this feels like politically cherry picking. And I want to go back to two things we started with to sort of close this conversation on. One is this idea that Barr cares about the morale of the department. There's nothing that is worse for the morale of attorneys if you think that the decisions you make will be undercut. And if the attorney general doesn't like your decision about someone, particularly in a political corruption case where someone may be a friend of the president, that there's going to be another U.S. attorney or some other office that's going to stand in judgment of you, and potentially in a political way. I mean, that is, I can't think of anything that's worse for morale than something like this.
Yeah.
And then the last piece is, again, it goes back to actions over words. Like Barr can say he feels like the president is pushing him to do things that he doesn't like. But one of two things is true. One thing is that Barr is engaging in political behavior, in my view, on his own behalf, or he's engaging in political behavior on the president's behalf, because the actions are really, really, this kind of conduct, it stands completely out of precedent. And it really does send the message that, you know, if you're prosecuting people who are foes of the president or friends of the president, that there's a different standard that applies. And again, it's the absolute worst thing in a system of the fair administration of justice.
As the president is fond of saying, Anne, we'll see what happens.
Yes. I'll talk to you soon, Preet. Take care.
Thanks so much.
See you next week. Bye.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the CAFE team is Julia Doyle, Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Calvin Lord, Sam Ozer-Staten, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.